We are talking today with Antonia Yuhas. Antonia Yuhas is a policy analyst, author, and activist living in San Francisco. She is a visiting scholar at the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Policy Studies. She is an expert on all aspects of international trade and finance policy with a master's degree in public policy from Georgetown University. She was the project director of the International Forum on Globalization, an alliance of 80 leading international scholars, economists, researchers, writers, and activists representing over 60 organizations in 25 countries. And she is here to talk about her new book, The Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time. Antonia, thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you would start out and tell us, what was the motivation in writing The Bush Agenda?
It's really 10 years worth of work working against the corporate globalization agenda of first the Clinton administration and now the Bush administration. But 9 days after September 11th, my future was sealed when Robert Zoellick, the U.S. Trade Representative, announced that we would be countering terror with trade and that free trade would be the tool that the Bush administration would use to counter terrorism. Clearly, under the guise of fighting the war on terrorism, the Bush administration was going to advance its own very unique and unilateral and radical form of corporate globalization policy. And I quickly turned my focus to finding out what that agenda was and how it was going to be implemented, and then learned while organizing against the war of the intense corporate globalization agenda implemented in Iraq. So while I call the book The Bush Agenda, what I trace in the book is the history of the key members of the Bush administration, how they came to develop an agenda that is essentially the overt linkage of the most aggressive use of the U.S. military, building the world's most insurmountable military, and using it to advance fairly traditional corporate globalization policies. That agenda is something that the Bush administration, or the members of the Bush administration, certainly hope will outlast the current president, but has reached its most aggressive implementation under this president, which is why I call it the Bush Agenda. And in Iraq, the Bush administration used a military invasion to completely restructure the political and economic infrastructure of Iraq to lock in the most radical corporate globalization policies, those that have been sought after and failed at the World Trade Organization through the Free Trade Area of the Americas, provisions such as the radical investment provisions that are found in the North American Free Trade Agreement, which give essentially corporations just unprecedented rights, no requirements where they work, when they work, how to invest their money, who to hire, when to go, when to stay. And these have all been implemented in Iraq just because the U.S. invaded. And as the president has repeatedly said, Iraq is only the beginning and the rest of the Middle East is now in his sights. So I sought with the book to understand who is this administration, who are these men in particular, what is their motivation, who are their backers, which led me to focus on four corporations, Halliburton, Bechtel, Lockheed Martin, and Chevron. How is this agenda being advanced and where do they hope to go with it so that all of this information would inform my own activism and the activism of the movements that I'm a part of so that we can better dismantle this agenda and replace it.
So where a lot of people have been repeating the idea that the Bush administration didn't have a plan after the invasion, you're kind of saying the exact opposite. They had a plan and it's been in the works for a while.
Yeah, they had a definite post-invasion plan. And it was written 2 months before the invasion of Iraq by a company called Bearing Point Inc., which received a $250 million contract to write an entirely new economic infrastructure for Iraq. That plan was then put into place by L. Paul Bremer, the administrator of the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq, who reigned for 14 months. He was named by Lakhdar Brahimi, the UN Special Envoy to Iraq, as the new dictator of Iraq, which he was. He had full legislative, legal authority over Iraq and all of its laws and all of its people. And in that position as occupier and head of the occupation government, the United States had two very specific international legal mandates that it had to uphold. As an occupier under the Hague Conventions, which we are a party to, the United States was responsible for providing for the safety and security and the basic needs of the Iraqi citizens: water, electricity, sewage, security in the streets. The United States was explicitly not allowed to fundamentally change the laws of the nation which it was occupying. We essentially did the exact opposite. We did not provide security, obviously. We didn't provide basic services, and we completely transformed the economy to meet our own needs. So Paul Bremer implemented the plan of Bearing Point and then appointed, after Paul Bremer left Iraq, he put in place an interim government that was appointed by him. The members of that interim government then carried out the Bremer orders, or the Bush agenda in Iraq, such that the current government of Iraq guarantees the Bush administration three things. First of all, it does not oppose the occupation. It does not oppose the economic restructuring, which I can detail. And it does not oppose the transformation of the oil sector, which is the most important sector, which is now just about to be, unless we have something to say about it, turned over to U.S. oil corporations. And that will be the ultimate success of this agenda in Iraq.
Yeah, if you would go into more Bremer's, I believe it was like a 100-point plan.
It's a good name for it. There were 100 orders, but I like the 100-point plan as well. There are 100 orders exactly that he implemented. And I detail these in the book, and I'll just highlight the most important ones here. Two of the most damning were the very first two orders. The very first order fired 120,000 of all key members of every Iraqi ministry. They were supposedly fired because they were members of the Ba'ath Party. However, it was a prerequisite to be in the civil service to be a member of the Ba'ath Party. So there was no indication whatsoever that these were people who were party to Hussein's horrific abuses. They were simply bureaucrats. They were fired because they would be the key people who would stand in the way of the imposition of the new economic structure. The second order was the firing of the entire Iraqi military. Now, this is important for a lot of reasons. 500,000 men, armed, sent home. No pay, no jobs. They went into an Iraqi society that already had 50% unemployment. So this is 500,000 men. The original plan of the U.S. military had been that the Iraqi military would be hired to do the reconstruction. They would receive a paycheck, and they would do the reconstruction. Instead, with the Bremer orders, 150 U.S. corporations were brought in. They received $50 billion for work in Iraq. One of the Bremer orders, national treatment, which is a very standard free trade component, made it impossible for the Iraqis to give preference to Iraqi companies or workers in the reconstruction. And believe me, as I delineate in the book, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of private and public Iraqi companies more than capable of performing this work. They were bypassed. U.S. companies came in. So the former Iraqi soldiers, with their guns, watch as Bechtel, Parsons, Shaw, Halliburton come into their country, receive billions of dollars, and utterly fail at the work they're sent in to perform. So Bechtel is a wonderful example, one of my favorites because they're based in San Francisco, where I'm from. They had $2.8 billion to rebuild water and electricity and sewage in Iraq. They spent 5 months assessing the situation, walking around, looking at things. This was summer in Iraq. That meant there was no electricity. Electricity in Iraq controls water and sewage. No water, no sewage systems. So you've got 500,000 men without pay, armed, watching as their families suffer brutally in the summer heat in Baghdad. When 3 months after the first Gulf War, the Iraqis rebuilt their water, electricity, and sewage systems within 3 months. It's been 3 years. The opposition to the occupation was obviously dramatically increased in that time and continued to be simply for the lack of basic services. At the same time, the Bremer orders made it so that no money earned by U.S. companies needed to be reinvested in Iraq. They could take all of their money and send it back home, so there was no guaranteed benefit to the Iraqi economy. It allowed for 100% foreign ownership of Iraqi businesses, including the banking sector. So J.P. Morgan Chase, which has been at least found guilty in participating in the Enron scandal, was the first U.S. bank in the door. The order allowed for full privatization of Iraq's state-owned industries, which is about 200 industries. In Iraq, the privatization order was faced with the most aggressive resistance. Because as Paul Bremer, before he became administrator of the U.S. occupation government, ran his own company called Marsh Consulting. And what Marsh Consulting did, I actually found a paper that he wrote while he was at Marsh Consulting, where he outlined all of the deadly effects of corporate globalization policy. So he said, privatization leads to services being cut off, leads to unemployment, people being fired, and that leads to civil unrest. Globalization policy leads to dramatic inequality and therefore civil unrest. And the whole point of this paper was so that he could give advice to multinational corporations going overseas about what the trouble they would encounter because of corporate globalization policy so that they would buy risk insurance from him. So this was his experience going into Iraq. And he proceeded to implement all of those same policies and essentially protect U.S. multinational corporations while he was there. So privatization was met with great resistance among the people of Iraq, and that slowed the process down tremendously. Unfortunately, it has still continued, but through more back channels, international meetings, the U.S. Commerce Department shipping the heads of Iraqi ministries around the United States to sort of sell their ministry wares. The first industry that's been partially privatized is the telecommunications sector. Water is supposed to be the next industry, and that it's going to go in a slower rate. Also, the foreign investment provisions that I was speaking about earlier that just give U.S. companies a carte blanche in access to Iraq and also made it possible for those 150 U.S. corporations to get their contracts. Also, the right wing has been wanting in the United States to implement a flat tax forever. Well, they did it in Iraq overnight because they could. Dropped the corporate tax rate down 25%. Just created a sort of free-for-all in the country. Now, the positive benefits to U.S. companies have been, at a minimum, those 150 U.S. corporations, the Halliburtons, the Bechtels, the Parsons, that have received those large contracts. But more importantly, maybe the groundwork that was laid by the Bremer orders for the new oil law. So also Bearing Point's contract included a reworking of the oil law. At the same time, in the Bush administration, there was a State Department working group on the oil and energy sector in Iraq. They met in 2002 and then also in 2003. A participant of that group was a man named Bara Alum, who was in the United States but was an Iraqi. After Bremer left Iraq, Bara Alum became the new oil minister of Iraq. In that position, one of the most important things he did was cancel all of the pre-existing oil contracts that Saddam Hussein had signed with other countries. They're all gone now. If you remember the Cheney Energy Task Force, 10 days after Bush took the presidency, Cheney organized a task force that was Bechtel, Halliburton, Chevron, Exxon, all of our friends. They wrote out a document called Foreign Suitors to Iraqi Oil, which listed all of the foreign companies with which Saddam Hussein had signed oil contracts. None of them were for the United States, obviously. None of these contracts could take effect while the sanctions were in place. It became very clear that global public opinion was turning aggressively against the sanctions because of the horrible impacts they were having in Iraq, that the sanctions were going to get removed. These businesses and the Bush administration saw the writing on the wall. The sanctions would get removed, and then Saddam Hussein would sign those contracts with all the other oil companies except the United States. So we invaded, we canceled the contracts, and we rewrote Iraq's oil infrastructure so that the new law that is now ready to be implemented, and the person who's going to implement it is Abdelmadi, who's the current vice president of Iraq, who was appointed by Bremer as the first finance minister of Iraq and has then become vice president twice. He came to the United States about a year ago and told U.S. oil companies that this new oil law is going to be really great for them and they needed to get behind him. The new oil law opens all of Iraq's undeveloped fields. So Iraq has 80 oil fields, 17 are developed. All the rest would be open to foreign private corporate investment on terms that are highly favorable to the foreign companies as opposed to Iraq. And it's U.S. oil companies that are now ready to sign those contracts. What they need is a security force to make it safe for them to get to work. What better security force than 150,000 American soldiers? So I argue that unless we have quite a bit to do about it, the oil timeline is what's going to drive the end of the war, not any other timeline that the president has talked about, certainly not a democracy timeline.
And my understanding is that these companies, the four companies you focus on in your mm-hmm. book, actually have been pushing for policy in Iraq for far longer than the current conflict.
Absolutely. I go back about 20 years trying to trace U.S. economic history with Iraq to see what these companies have been doing and what the U.S. government's relationship to Iraq has been from an economic perspective, why we needed to invade when we invaded. And what you see is, particularly with these companies, extremely intense, active, profitable engagements with Saddam Hussein that started under Reagan, intensified dramatically under Bush Sr., and were aggressively lobbied for by the U.S. Iraq Business... I forget the own name, my own name in the book. I think it's the U.S. Iraq Business Council, but read the book and you'll find the name. And Kissinger Associates. And you know, Henry Kissinger, you can't talk about modern politics and not talk about Henry Kissinger. And Bechtel, Halliburton, Lockheed Martin, and Chevron were active in lobbying to increase U.S. connections with Saddam Hussein because there was a lot of money to be made there, right? A lot of oil. Bechtel built and managed a petrochemical complex in Iraq that developed the precursor to mustard gas, who essentially helped Saddam Hussein gas his people and Iranian people. Halliburton had people working in Iraq literally on the day that Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. Lockheed Martin had been selling arms for quite a long time, including helicopters, all sorts of dual-use technology because direct sale of arms wasn't permitted. And Chevron has been working as Texaco or Chevron in Iraq since the 30s. The intense economic relationship with Saddam Hussein, what I point to in the book, was a very conscious decision of these companies and these two earlier presidents. They received memos from their own cabinet that would say, you know, this man is a brutal, horrific dictator. You know, he's evil. He kills people that don't listen to him. But we really think you need to continue engaging economically with him because he has so much oil. I mean, it's basically just spelled out. And Reagan and Bush Sr. went aggressively with that path. And U.S. corporations pushed them in that direction. Basically, when Hussein invaded Kuwait, all bets were off. And something else that Hussein did was he called off a oil pipeline deal with Bechtel that really pissed off the American business sector. It was a huge oil pipeline deal that would have carried Iraqi oil out of the port of Aqaba, Jordan, and Bechtel would have built it. And they lobbied to get Hussein, George Shultz, who was Secretary of State at the time, previously for 8 years, the president of the Bechtel Corporation, left the Bechtel Corporation to become Secretary of State. As Secretary of State, lobbied aggressively for Bechtel's opportunity to operate in Iraq. This pipeline deal fell apart because Hussein said that he didn't trust the safety of the pipeline through Israel. And that was sort of the beginning of the writing on the wall, that he wasn't going to agree to everything we wanted him to agree to. And then he invaded Kuwait. And then George Bush says in my book, you know, we can't let him have access to all of this oil. He can't have both his own oil in Iraq, Kuwait's oil, Saudi Arabia's oil. It's time to get rid of this guy. This isn't working out. What makes George Bush Jr. so different from George Bush Sr. is that his Bush Jr.'s administration didn't just seek to replace Saddam Hussein, just this one person, which is what Bush Sr. tried to do. His administration has gone significantly farther and has said, look, it's not enough to just replace the head of the government. They are far more imperial. They say, no, we have to transform the economic and political infrastructure to lock in our interests regardless of who is the head of the government. And they have succeeded. And that makes them truly imperial in a way that I don't think any modern U.S. president has been. Their next sight is on the rest of the Middle East through this U.S. Middle East Free Trade Area, which, you know, basically, if you look at Central America, South America, Africa, these are poor regions that had to succumb to the policies of the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO. They didn't have a choice financially and had to change their laws in accordance to these institutions. The Middle East has largely been immune from that same process because of all the oil wealth. Hasn't had to bust open their laws to U.S. corporate access. However, the Bush administration has succeeded where all other U.S. administrations have failed because they are demanding changes at the point of a gun, basically, and have developed a new negotiating structure where the free trade area of the Americas has been stymied because the developing countries have stood up as a block and said, we're not going to cede to your interests. So in the Middle East, what they are doing is bilateral negotiations. Each country has to negotiate with the United States individually. Each of those bilateral agreements will then be linked together into a free trade area, which means that each individual country has to stand head-to-head against the United States. They can't team up and work together. And so the negotiations are moving ahead brutally, quickly. And there was a magnificent front-page article on the New York Times business section yesterday about the impacts of one of those first agreements, the U.S.-Jordan Free Trade Agreement, and just demonstrating the horrific slave labor conditions that have now appeared in U.S. apparel factories in Jordan, factories that service Walmart, Target, JCPenney, Jones New York, I think was one of them. Just the worst of the worst, and I've read about some pretty bad sweatshop conditions. This was literally workers working 48 hours without sleep, then given 2 hours to sleep on the floor of the factory, workers being brought from other countries and having their passports taken away from them so that they couldn't leave, not getting paid, not being allowed to go to the bathroom, being beaten if they complained. The list goes on. And this is a direct result of the free trade rules being removed to allow corporations to operate now in Jordan without essentially anyone watching over their shoulders and being able to ship their products in cheaply to be made in Jordan and then ship out cheaply to be sold back in the United States. The very bad news, in addition to the conditions for the workers, obviously, is that these policies are fueling intense hatred against the United States across the region. And we're going to be, kicked in the ass as a result of these policies if we don't change them.
So have the countries in the Middle East not communicated between themselves about the deals they've been individually negotiating with the U.S.?
No, because the problem is they are on the losing end of this stick, and it's actually a better deal for each country to get on board quickly, because once the United States negotiates with country A, it's going to demand the same things from country B that it got from country A. Once it gets something from A and B, then country C is going to have to meet those same demands. And what we're seeing, as opposed to countries holding back so that they can come together, is that the countries in the Middle East have too much to lose. So, for example, Saudi Arabia just turned over well over $1 trillion in private investment opportunities, including in the energy sector, to U.S. companies, something utterly unheard of in Saudi Arabia, where everything is controlled by the state. They did this because essentially the Bush administration threatened to cut off the, umbilical link that we have with that nation with all of the billions of dollars in arms that we provide them, not to mention 5,000 U.S. soldiers stationed in Saudi Arabia. If the Bush administration pulled the plug, obviously that regime could no longer stay in place. And this trade negotiation was a bribe, a huge bribe. The United States, the Commerce Department, Exxon, Chevron took the Saudi business leaders on a tour of the United States, at which the Saudi business leaders basically, you know, displayed their wares and, you know, opened up all these privatization opportunities to U.S. companies to no advantage to Saudi Arabia other than to keep the U.S. off their back. Each country is falling in line. That's what's happening. And there is definitely public resistance in the Middle East, but there's very little knowledge or awareness. There's very little freedom of information in most of these countries. And what I have been working very hard to do, my book is going to be published in Arabic by a Middle East publisher. And I'm going to tour the Middle East because I've been just told over and over again, we need information, we need information, we need information. And we need to open channels of dialogue between Middle East opponents of free trade policies and the anti-corporate globalization movement in the United States, where we have worked in partnership in Central America, South America, Africa. There's very little of that same kind of partnership between the United States and the Middle East. And part of it is the fear that the Bush administration puts over us, right? If you're partnering with people in the Middle East, you must be a terrorist. You must be, you know, your phone will be bugged. It probably will be, but that's okay. I say everything on the radio anyway. You know, and that's terrible, obviously. That is the worst possible outcome in my mind, that our own peaceful connections with other people around the world are being stymied. But that is the key element that is missing in the Middle East, is access to knowledge about what these agreements are, how they're proceeding. But once the effects are felt, there has been quite a bit of public outrage in the Middle East, but it's come after the fact.
And of course, once the effects are being felt, then in a lot of ways it's too late.
It can definitely be too late. I mean, you've certainly got the political interests embedded at that point, the U.S. companies embedded at that point, and it's much harder to disengage. Yeah.
We're talking today with Antonia Juhas. She is author of the new book, The Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time. Getting back to Iraq and the Bush administration's machinations there, a lot of people here in the U.S. might get the impression that Iraq really didn't have a constitution prior to us arriving.
That was one of the most heinous aspects of the whole discussion put forward by the Bush administration during the time when the U.S. was essentially writing the new constitution of Iraq, that this was our great gift of freedom to the people of Iraq, that we were granting them a constitution. Well, constitutional government goes back to 1922 in Iraq. The constitution in place when we invaded was written 7 years before Saddam Hussein even became president of Iraq. And while badly abused by Hussein, it was not a constitution that if Americans read, and I've read it, would have tremendous problems with, except for that it gave significantly greater power to the president than most constitutions that we're familiar with. Although our own constitution is being so badly abused and so much power is residing in our president that we might be very familiar with it. What Iraq had was a social welfare state that was very successful in spite of the brutal dictator that ruled the country. In essence, there was a very good government that was functioning very well in spite of its ruler to deliver spectacular social services to its population prior to the first Gulf War. So Iraq was had one of the highest rates of water provision, a very sophisticated water system. 90% of the public received water, which was very high in the Middle East. High education, high maternal and child health, guaranteed education, guaranteed health care. And all of this was guaranteed in the Constitution. That constitution was thrown out when the United States decided that it was going to rewrite a new constitution for Iraq. And actually, there was the temporary constitution, which was then replaced by the permanent constitution of Iraq, accepted in the public vote. In the writing of the permanent constitution, many Iraqi parliamentarians tried very aggressively to put back in some of the social welfare provisions of the earlier of the original Constitution. They tried to put in provisions that would put a deadline on the occupation, that would make it impossible for the United States to build permanent military bases in Iraq, or anyone for that matter that wasn't Iraqi, that would try and rein in the Bremer orders. None of those provisions made it into the final constitution that was then voted on by the Iraqi public. In fact, the constitution that was voted on by the Iraqi public, only 5 million copies were printed. There are 15 million voters. Those copies did not come out until 5 days prior to the vote. The same day that the 5 million paper copies arrived, Zalmay Khalilzad, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, who's also very much part of the Bush agenda team, has been working intimately with Wolfowitz since the early 80s in the Reagan administration, and very much a part of this neoconservative project for the New American Century group. He met with a handpicked group of Iraqi officials, and they changed the Constitution the same day that the paper copy was released to the public. So Iraqis came out, risked their lives to vote for the Constitution, voted for hope, voted for change, but certainly did not vote for the words that were in the Constitution. And the words in the Constitution locked in all of the Bremer orders, locked in the economic transformation of the country, locked in the constitutionality of the new oil law. So the oil law could still be changed. Any of the laws could be changed, but they are constitutional by the writing of the new Constitution of Iraq. And the Constitution of Iraq used to guarantee that Iraq's oil was a public good to be used by the state on behalf of the people of Iraq. That's not at all what Iraq has now. The new Constitution allows for the privatization of the oil sector and the opening of it to private foreign investment. And essentially, what has happened with the government of Iraq is that the United States has clearly had undue influence on its members. Now, if the Bush administration was to carve out a government out of clay for who it would want to rule Iraq, that's not who these men are. But these men, almost all of them that are in the head of the administration, the new Iraqi administration, participated in the hand-picked administration by Paul Bremer. And what is very uncommon, almost unheard of, in a post-occupation restructuring, the interim government appointed by the occupier, those people are not supposed to be allowed to run again because they are in a clearly preferential position. In fact, in the first election in which Iraqis were allowed to vote, 3,000 of the candidates didn't even make their names known to the public that they were running, much less their positions on, you know, what they stood for, because they were afraid of being assassinated. And they were right to be afraid. 9 people were assassinated who were candidates. So again, the Iraqi public has come out, risked their lives time and again to participate in democracy, in a complete fallacy, the idea of democracy. If you don't know who you're voting for, that's not democracy. So that's who this government is. And this government is participating in this Bush plan. Now, all that said, the members of the Bush administration did not expect the level of intense opposition to their policies that the Iraqi public has displayed, and the intense opposition to the occupation. Hundreds of thousands of peaceful protests all the time, regularly, in Iraq against this agenda, and obviously an intense violent resistance as well. The Bush administration did not count on this early in the game, 70% of U.S. soldiers fighting in Iraq saying that they want this war over in a year. They did not count on 70% of the American public opposing the war. And this is not guaranteed. This agenda is not guaranteed. It's not locked in. They could still lose the whole game. And that's where we come in.
Well, I want to get back to that in just a bit. So it sounds like what the Bush administration has got going here is really a international corporation's wet dream in Iraq.
I mean, I wouldn't describe that way, but yeah. But you can. I mean, it is. You know, as I said, it's the same policies that we've all been fighting at every institution, every international institution, and having tremendous success at. I mean, let's not forget that the anti-corporate globalization movement has stymied the World Trade Organization, has stymied the Free Trade Area of the Americas. Social movements guided by the ideas of the anti-corporate globalization movement have replaced entire government leaders in country after country, having representatives that actually represent the alternative agenda that we all imagine can happen. Bolivia is a wonderful example. And the Bush administration decided that it wouldn't use the international institutions because it basically couldn't in the way that it would have liked to, and has instead proceeded in a unilateral fashion and done so particularly aggressively in Iraq. And Iraq shows us, you know, Bechtel, there's an employee of Bechtel had a very good quote that I have in the book where they say, look, Iraq can be a very wealthy nation. It has a tremendous amount of oil. It has a tremendous amount of water. You know, this is a great long-term investment for us to be here, and, you know, we want to stay here long-term. Bechtel would have liked to have privatized Iraq's water by now. Bechtel would like to have more than just reconstruction contracts in Iraq. They haven't succeeded because it isn't safe in Iraq. That what I think is that, you know, the administration has short-term sites and long-term sites. The long-term sites are about opening up, taking as much of the Middle East resources as possible. So, again, very imperial, but doing it through its corporations. And I don't think the administration wants to invade the entire Middle East, but is doing fine by having its corporations do that. And Iraq sort of busted open that access. It's the great big stick behind the carrot is the free trade agreement, right? You can sign a free trade agreement. If you don't sign a free trade agreement, we've got a nice little, you know, military back here that'll teach you what's what. And they've already shown that they'll do it. And believe me, people in the Middle East feel that pressure. Even if we say back home, oh, you know, we can't let soldiers loose all across the Middle East. That's not what people in the Middle East feel. They feel the threat of the Bush administration. But the short-term goal of thinking that they could bust open Iraq, change all the laws, bring in U.S. corporations, and everything would be fine and dandy was where they were mistaken. The Iraqi public didn't accept that transformation. That short-term goal has essentially succeeded in transferring a tremendous amount of wealth to U.S. corporations, some $50 billion worth of our money. That's not bad. It's helped make Halliburton and Lockheed's share value increase 3- and 4-fold since the war began. Chevron has had its most profitable years in its 125-year history, 2-year running. Bechtel's profits have skyrocketed. I mean, these companies are doing just great. The longer-term agenda then becomes the oil agenda. And that can succeed even if there isn't enough stability for, say, Bechtel to come in and privatize. And the question is, you know, are we going to be able to help make it so that the whole economic invasion can be withdrawn in the same way that the military invasion, we hope, will be withdrawn? And obviously, they're banking on the fact that it will stay in place. The success, however, of what the transformations that they've put in place in Iraq are seen in the transformations being put in place through the U.S. Middle East Free Trade Area. They, as you say, created their wet dream in Iraq and are now being able to implement it elsewhere in a way that they would not have been able to do without the invasion.
Bounce back a little bit to the Bush administration itself. Has this administration pretty much reset the bar for corporate influence and control of an administration?
I think so. And you know, as someone who's been looking at this for a long time, you know, I definitely think that there's an unprecedented wedding between the two. There's basically no line between corporate and government interests in this administration. You know, on the simple face value aspects, this is the first time in American history that the president, vice president, and secretary of state are all former energy or oil company officials. The president and the secretary of state have more experience working for oil companies than they do as public officials. Condoleezza Rice is famously known for having a Chevron tanker named after her, but less well known is that she earned it. She worked for 10 years on the board of directors of Chevron as the head of their policy committee. These were 10 years in which Chevron had some of the most horrific practices of any company in Ecuador, in Africa, all across the world, which I detail extensively in the book. But Condoleezza Rice is treated as if she, you know, is basically just the president's lapdog. This is a very intelligent woman who has her very own political history, and much of that political history is tied to the oil industry. The, you know, vice president has more experience working for government than he does working for a private company, but one could certainly argue that his 5 years at Halliburton far outstrip the at least profit-making capacity of both Condoleezza Rice and the president. And Cheney has just topped all bars for how to, you know, eliminate any distinction between who you're working for, whether you're working for the government or you're working for a company. And his work with Halliburton and Halliburton's work for the government has been detailed extensively. There are some 16 current members of the Bush administration who are former Lockheed Martin officials. It is an unprecedented number of one company being represented in one government. That is an umbilical link between government and private industry. Most of the people who are either working in the Bush administration, who were working at Lockheed, or were in the Bush administration and are now working at Lockheed, were in acquisitions, you know, on either side. So they're basically just, you know, selling themselves stuff back and forth. Lockheed's doing great since the invasion. Oh, and Dick Cheney also happens to own stock in both Lockheed and Halliburton. So he's also still doing quite well. This administration received 13 times more money from the oil industry than their challengers in 2000. 13 times. It's a tremendous amount of money. 9 times more in the 2004 election cycle. And basically, the industry is getting what it paid for. This administration has provided subsidies, tax breaks, deregulation, and allowed for a tremendous amount of vertical integration within the oil sector. So not just horizontal, so Exxon teaming with Mobil, Chevron teaming with Texaco, teaming with Unocal, Conoco, and Phillips, but vertical integration, which means that the same companies do the exploration, the production, the refining, the marketing, the sales, which means that they control supply. The 10 largest oil companies produce more oil a day than Saudi Arabia does. They control price. 30% of every dollar is refining, marketing, profits, and sales. If you have the same company doing all of that, they determine what to do with that 30 cents. About 47 cents is a cost of a barrel of crude oil. The rest is federal and state taxes. The rest they determine. So the Bush administration has allowed this industry to take over our supply and sales of this important resource and allowed them to essentially transfer all of the costs associated with every aspect of providing us with that resource to the consumer, which is why, you know, as long as demand stays high, the prices are certainly only going to skyrocket, as long as the oil companies have anything to do with it, and as long as this administration is in charge.
Doesn't that also kind of illustrate the lie with the concept that our dependence on foreign oil, you know, somehow that if we're drilling oil out of the U.S., then the rest of the world, that it'll be cheaper?
No logic in that whatsoever. It's the same company, so it doesn't matter where they're getting the oil from. In addition to the fact that actually drilling for oil in the United States is more expensive than drilling for oil in most places because we have better regulations, even if this administration would like to strip them down. Also, the refining of oil in the United States is expensive because we try and mitigate the damning pollutants and chemicals that we put into our refining and the finished product. So it doesn't make any sense at all.
All right. One more question before we get to solutions.
Yeah.
Assuming all things remained the same, which, of course, they don't, can we really expect future administrations to be beholden to corporations if the current arc continues on its way?
I don't think there's been a single United States administration that was not beholden to U.S. corporations. So we're going to have to continue to engage in radical change to see that future. But there is less levels of beholdenness, and there is more democracy that can be achieved. So it's not just, you know, it doesn't just feel bad to have ExxonMobil have such high profits. It's very bad for our democracy to have ExxonMobil have such high profits, because it allows them to have undue influence over the members of our government, which then makes it so that we cannot have the level of influence over the members of our government that we need. So we need to have a government that is less beholden to corporations and is more responsive to our interests. And that we certainly can achieve. But it's not just by replacing Bush with God knows who. It's by the building up the power of our social movements to be so powerful that there is no choice but for elected officials to respond, and that we make the changes at the local and the state level so it is less relevant what happens at the federal level. And we demand the type of changes that we need to see. For example, we can tax oil companies in California, where I'm from. We are trying to impose a windfall profits tax on California-based oil companies such as Chevron. And it doesn't matter if there's a federal windfall profits tax or not, if we can do it at the state level. And we can redirect that tax money into public transportation, into alternative fuels, into subsidizing low-income households for heat or air conditioning. We can also implement, obviously, all kinds of tremendous changes that have nothing to do with policymakers. So we can, you know, create alternative fuel sources in our local community that are easier for households to hook into. We can work on transportation in our local community. We can reduce our use of cars in our local community. That's just in the oil sector, all the things that we can do. But to see all of that local organizing that we do as the key to shaping the international, national policymaking, that we unseat the Bush agenda through all of that organizing, as well as when we work on campaigns. And that the one-time campaign work is important, but it's a teeny little part of all of the work that all of us do to actually implement the alternatives to the Bush agenda that we want to have. So I don't think, you know, I hate those bumper stickers that I see that say, you know, is it 2008 yet? You know, we can't put our heads in the sand. There's just too much at stake. And I think it is important to get rid of these guys. I think these guys are unique and they're deadly and they're going to kill us all if we don't have something to do about it. But particularly federal elections are just one piece. And that we often feel overly defeated. Lots of people tried to work to unseat Bush, to keep him from getting elected the first time. 15 million people marched against the war. And when we don't see immediate change, many people go home and feel defeated. Well, that organizing that went into unseating Bush, that organizing that went in when I was in, you know, San Francisco and we shut down the city the day after the war, that organizing carries on in our communities such that we develop a dialogue, we develop connections with soldiers when they return from Iraq and oppose the war, with families that oppose the war of soldiers, with traditional, you know, peace and justice communities, with anti-Bush organizers that have made it so that we are in this state where only 30% of the public supports the president or the war. That didn't happen magically, but we're not going to see headlines that say peace movement, you know, leads to tremendous transformation in the American public's views. We have to make those headlines and embrace them for ourselves and see that all of that work is leading to change, does lead to change, and can continue, you know, to do so in the future as we unseat this entire agenda.
And do you remain hopeful that, for instance, the laws you're trying to enact in California can go up against organizations like the WTO, which organizations like your former one, IFG, have so successfully gone against?
We have to enact them regardless. That one of the ways that we challenge the World Trade Organization is by writing the laws that we want and letting the fight come, and then showing how ridiculous the institution is. And we, you know, certainly taxing the oil industry is not counter World Trade Organization regulations. But many of the other alternatives that people have implemented across the United States are, for example, making what are called MAI-free zones, zones that would not implement the Multilateral Agreement on Investment if it was enacted, or local purchasing laws, or requiring companies to foreign companies to invest a certain amount of their money locally. Any of these policies, anti-big box legislation, if those big box companies are non-American. All of these are contradict World Trade Organization provisions. There haven't been suits on these laws yet. And the main reason would be, I think, that the companies think that they would lose because of the power of the United States, unfortunately. The more that we can act and fight the institutions by enacting the policies that we want, the stronger we are. And, you know, let the fight come is what I say.
All right. And in addition to your book, The Bush Agenda, what resources do you recommend people to turn to?
In addition to my book, everything's in my book. On my website, thebushagenda.org, I have a recommended reading section, which has a ton of books. There's so many things that I think are good for people to read. I have an enormous bibliography in my book. If you don't want to buy the book, go to the library and look at the bibliography and look at my endnotes, because that's all the people I think are important to read. You know, off the top of my head, I think that some very important books that I have read recently, I highly recommend this book, which might be unusual, so I'll say it, is Francis Fukuyama's new book. He is one of the old school neoconservatives. He was a part of the Project for the New American Century. He was a part of the Bush senior administration, this administration. He strongly advocated for war against Iraq, unseating Saddam Hussein. He has now written a book where he says this administration doesn't deserve the name neoconservative, and they have so sullied it that I need to come up with a different name, because they are imperial, because they have taken it to such an extreme, because they are so abusive to the rights of other nations, because they are so unilateral, because they are so blind. I cannot even embrace the name neoconservative anymore. And it is one of the most damning critiques of this administration that I've read from someone inside, very much inside the inner circle. And maybe he's just trying to protect his ass, but it's very good stuff anyway. But yeah, there's lots of really great books on my website that I recommend.
Very good. And your website again is?
TheBushAgenda.org.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
We've just been speaking with Antonia Juhas, and she is the author of the new book, The Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time.